I'm Dr. Megan Corrado, and welcome to Real Stories, a podcast that features the narratives of trauma survivors, professionals, and community leaders. Real Stories provides a platform for guests with diverse life experiences to voice and honor their unique narratives. During today's episode, we will be speaking with Franco Roman. Franco, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start off. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
So I am Franco Roman, otherwise known as Francisco Roman, or Frankie, as my mother used to call me. I was born in New York. My parents are both from Puerto Rico, and I grew up in New York. Came to Philadelphia at around 1983, and then stayed until I finished school, went back to New York, and returned in 1989, got married, had a family, started a career, social work, then in 1997 in the fire department as a dual career. And I've been doing that since that time.
Okay. So let's segue into you telling us a little bit about what you do.
So what I do, the way that I see what I do from my own perspective is that I help people. I've always felt called to help others. I enjoy helping others. And what I mean about helping people is in a variety of ways. So I work at the Children's Crisis Treatment Center, and I've been there for now since 99. So what does that make that? 21 years this year?
Wow.
And before that, I worked at other places in as a social worker in Philadelphia. Always with children, always with families. And the way I contribute is I enjoy helping provide a safe environment where people can grow and develop, get past some of the things that they face, some of the challenges they face in their lives, and find some contentment in their life and some happiness and some personal peace. And I work with children because I think that's a great place to start when you're doing that. And I work in the fire department because I also enjoy excitement. So I enjoy working in from time to time in a chaotic situation, or at least where every day doesn't look like the other. And I enjoy working with teams to, you know, try to help people during very dire crises, and sometimes very bland crises. I mean, sometimes people just do things that are accidental and they're not so, you know, it's not that much of a crisis, but it's a range from the sky is falling to my finger stuck in a hole kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting combination. So social work and firefighting. Do you find there to be any parallels between those two choices of professions?
Actually, yes. There's a lot of parallels. The first thing is it's the way that they're exactly the same is that when you're helping people, when you're offering help to people who need it, you're there to do as much as someone would allow you to do at the moment. So the way that they're the same is that, you know, you can help people as much as they'll allow you to, and within the limits of and scope of your job, right? Or what it is, your focus of what it is that you do, or people are the auspices of whatever agency, whether it's here or the fire department, whatever, you know, within those limits, within those boundaries that you're able to do. they're a little different in with the fire department because you're allowed to go a little beyond what you would normally do for someone, because sometimes you're working with people who aren't able to provide consent at the moment, right? They may be unconscious or disabled or in critical types of situations where you have to act on what you know the person might need to get them to safety.
Okay.
And I like working within that full range. I enjoy working within that full range. It makes it always keeps things interesting.
And, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about all these different potential parallels and thinking about, like, figuratively and literally all these different connections between firefighting and social work. And you specialize in social work with individuals, families, youth who've experienced trauma as well. I'm sure you've heard a lot of different stories of trauma and a lot of stories of resilience in the course of your work, especially, you know, seeing as you've been working in the field for 21 years. That's a lot of different narratives, a lot of different experiences that you've had that you've played a role in providing support in the midst of.
Well, God, trauma. So probably part of my own journey that brought me to work in situations that are traumatic probably has a lot to do with who I am, where I'm from, things that happened to me. And over the course of those years, and you know, added to the 21 years that here at CCTC, the fire department, it's at 24 years now, and altogether,
wow,
with the other agencies I worked with, more like 30 years.
Wow.
So I really began work in 1988.
Okay.
Right. So, how many years is that right now? So we're in 2020.
I'm a social worker. I'm really bad with
math.
Yeah,
we're 2020. And that would be, it's probably about 32 years.
Wow.
Actually working all together. And I had a lot of personal trauma growing up. And part of that journey, I don't know if that made me a social worker. I was born a social worker. I don't know. There's things I can remember since I was a kid about enjoying helping others.
Okay.
That was interesting. But over the years, I've learned that I wasn't going to fix the things that I felt were wrong in my life by helping others fix theirs. So I had to learn how to help myself and to find help and learn how to have some boundaries. And then over the years, I've had the pleasure of helping, you know, people that needed it and wanted it and were able to use it. And that makes me very proud and very happy. And a lot of them had trauma. I mean, most of them had trauma. I don't know how you avoid trauma. Most of them had trauma, whether it was separations at young age or, you know, severe diseases or abuse, neglect, loss, grief. A lot. It's hard to say that one or another experience stands out. Because they're a lot. They're many.
Mm-hmm. So every individual, every community, every system has a story. And we know that every story includes adversity, but every story also includes strength. Can you talk to us about some of the adversities that you have faced?
You want that chronological or by level of hurt?
However you are willing and able to share it. It doesn't have to be fully formulated in chronological sequence with a nice pretty bow. You can say it however it is meaningful to you.
So I would say that my first experiences with trauma were around my own sexual abuse. Mm. I was abused sexually when I was a child. My memory doesn't always, I haven't always been able to pinpoint a starting point. Mm-hmm. I was young. I was a young boy. Somewhere around 7 or 8, maybe. Mm-hmm. That impacted me profoundly. Mm. Then other things like, you know, traumas, suffering, you know, you can't have like a suffering competition with folks because, right. You know, every individual, it's very personal. Mm-hmm. But I could say that for me, I carried a lot of the a lot of the damage that I would say was done for a very long time. And I didn't start to recognize it until I was going to have my first child.
Okay.
With my wife. And that's when I realized how profound the impact of that experience was. Mm. Because I was scared I didn't know what to do. How I was going to be a good father. I was afraid to be a good father. Mm. Now, not that my father wouldn't have been helpful, but I couldn't tell my father when I was a boy what happened. Mm. And I didn't tell anyone. So
you were a little boy carrying around the weight of that on your own.
Yep, for a long time. And then the other things that were impacted, I mean, these are things that happened to everyone that I grew up with, so they're not special to me. But the, you know, the time I grew up was violent where I grew up. So there was a lot of violence and a lot of gangs and... it was very confusing. Hmm. So by the time I was 16, I had made some really bad choices that I think were directly connected to the trajectory that incident put me on. Hmm. And I don't want to say all like a victim. I had my choices. I mean, I could have done things differently. I had opportunities to do things differently, but I think I was incapable. And I don't blame myself anymore for being incapable, but I was at that time incapable of processing that experience and trying to give it its place and then move away from it or move... deal with that issue and then, you know, try to move in a more direct, a more positive trajectory. Instead, I took, by the time I was 9, 10, 11, I was already involved in drugs and alcohol. And by the time I was 14, 15, I was the word would be a thug, kind of like a thug, like, you know, someone who was doing harm to themselves and others.
Wow. And all of those things at such an early age, the trauma, the adversity, exposure to things in the community, and then your own kind of battles, all really early.
They were early. I'm kind of grateful they were early.
Yeah.
It gave me time. Like from this side of it, it was terrible. And, but I draw from those experiences a lot when I work with others.
Wow.
And I don't know. I don't want to say that that was the only thing that led me to do what I'm doing, or what I've been doing, but it had a lot to do with it, you know, and then there were other moments, you know, when my parents, used to own a boarding house, and many immigrants came to live with us. That were both legal and illegal, you know, at the time. They had permission and they didn't have permission to be here. And my mom and dad would protect them and try to help them, you know, get their information together and do things. And so from a very young age, I could remember going to the offices with them to translate. And that was kind of like some of my first helping experiences.
Wow.
And I enjoyed them. You know, and my parents would help other people. And so I watched them help other people. And as limited as my parents were in terms of their ability to help, meaning, you know, their resources or even their education, they made a huge impact on the lives of others. And who today, those families, you know, you know, their children progressed and became important to the community, you know, to their community and to the community that would have called their parents illegal at the time.
Wow. And you're saying your parents didn't have a ton of resources, but they used the resources that they had in order to provide support and assistance to whoever they could.
Yes, they had they had a very strong ethic, I would say, toward helping others. The problem that we had was that they had a strong ethic, but they also had other things, you know, that were very strong that I grew up with that were difficult to understand.
So let's shift gears. And can you share a few important positive moments or turning points in your story? Things that stand out to you as being something empowering, something that you're proud of?
So, after when I was 16, around 16, was the most violent my life became toward others. At that time, cocaine and other very serious drugs were, flooding the area where I lived, and things became very serious. The mischief, we went from mischief to criminal activity to just outright violence at times. And I, during that time, I overdosed. And it was at that moment, and due to other experiences in my life, by the way, I had a lot of kindnesses in my life, a ton of kindnesses. I have friends that are still alive, are still around, that are incredible. I have one friend that had he had muscular dystrophy, and I used to help him get around as he became disabled. And he became, he later, now he's an attorney, an accountant, and a judge, an elected judge. And we've still maintained friendships. I had influences like that. Influences from church. There was a synagogue next door to my house, and they were very kind. There was a church that I had my family attended, and they were very kind. My family did try to keep me as safe as possible without knowing what had happened to me or where my mind was. Mm-hmm. There was a great deal of things that contributed to resilience in my life. So even though these horrible things were happening, there was another part. It was almost like having two sides, like having, you know, a conflict within my mind and my spirit about how to be and who to be. And after I overdosed and I almost died.
Wow. At 16.
Yeah, that was at 16. I thought I was going to die. And so I sincerely started to pray at that moment. I remember praying. It wasn't on heroin. It was, and I could tell you the whole story, but it's, let's just say that I had the moment. I had a moment of clarity at the moment of my demise. Okay. And that moment of clarity, I asked for God's help. I asked for his help. I asked for his forgiveness. And I didn't ask to live. I didn't ask God to save me. Actually, I wanted to die. But I asked God too that if there was another life, that it wouldn't be like the one I had. That he would forgive me and allow me to live something other than hell. And I prayed that in Jesus' name. The next morning I woke up. And it didn't completely change my life. I'm not going to say that I turned around and I was all of a sudden, you know, the greatest person in the world. But something changed when I woke up. Something changed. I knew something was different. And for the next 3 years, I started to live a different life in steps, right? The church helped me. I had friends who didn't believe in church who helped me. Employers took on some role in mentoring me. People liked me. And they helped me. So by the time I was 19, I was going to go to, and I went, by the way, I went to a adolescent program. Not much different from what we would consider today, like a bit of a step down from a partial program. But a little bit high, like it wasn't in a normal
setting. Higher than outpatient.
Yeah, it wasn't in a normal setting. It was a program where you went and there were teachers that were brought in, there were counselors there. It was Jamaica Community Adolescent Program, and it was run old school by a bunch of ex addicts.
Okay.
Except for the teachers. It was really interesting, actually. When I look back.
Is it still around today?
It in a different form. It evolved later on because of, you know, this is years ago, right? This is when I was, 16. And back then, that's 40 years ago. Oh, no. 40 years. I'm 56 now. So it was when I was 16. 40 years ago. So it was very different. you know, it was the old, you know, people yelling at you, wearing signs, you know, doing all these things. But
during treatment?
Yes.
That is very different.
It was really different. But I could remember, one guy brought a gun to the, like a 357 to a group because he was angry. And I remember getting up and talking him down and happy wow. I didn't get shot. And, you know, yeah, it was that kind of place. It was crazy.
Mm.
But that those kinds of places is where it started. And by the time I was 19, I was going to go to the military, and the pastor was so corny. He says, Frank, wouldn't you rather be a navigator of men? And he was such a nice man, right? And I'm like, man, pastor, you really don't know what you're talking about. I respect you and all, but you know, you, and what happened was I was on my way to the recruitment center. Mm-hmm. I was on my way to swear in. I had taken the test and all. I was on my way to swear in. And by the way, I got my GED. That's the other thing in the program. I got my GED. I never graduated from high school. And so I was on my way to swear in, and I stopped by the church, and he asked me to stuff some bulletins for him. And he was watching me. And I kind of thought it was weird that he was watching me. Like, what are you watching me for? And he calls me in and he lays that line on me. Frank, wouldn't you rather be a navigator or a man? And I'm like, I'm on my way to the recruitment office. He goes, don't go. I don't want you to go. I want you to take a week and I want you to come back here with your father. And let's have a conversation. Now, when I said I was lucky I was young, that a lot of this stuff happened to me when I was young, it's because, like, all the trouble I got into, the trouble, the legal trouble, the stuff in the streets, all of that happened when I was very, very, very young.
Okay.
So because those 3 years of recovery occurred, by the time I was an adult, I had a chance.
Mm.
I had a chance. And that's one of the reasons that I believe in children's services so much, because the earlier, the better. You know, fine, bring them in preschool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's work with everybody until we get to high school. And then hopefully through this experience, we might put another fork in the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might do a bypass, right? You know how you have a heart bypass? It's the same thing. You're just trying to bypass that road to get you back onto the main artery. You know what I mean? So that you can get back on and live your life. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what happened to me. Right. And so I really believe in services. I believe in what I do. And it's not just for me. I know I've studied. I know I went to school. I went back to school and did all that. But In my soul, I feel like I contribute at least in little increments
to getting someone
to live a life.
Mm-hmm. And then thinking about like the process of change, I think sometimes we view change as happening in these really huge dramatic moments, and sometimes that's the way that change happens. And other times there are these incremental steps forward, and then you move backward and you move forward again. And then hopefully when you turn around and look back, you can say, wow, look at how far I've come. Even if it doesn't always feel like that at the time too.
Well, it's exactly like that. Sometimes you have big moments, right? And other times it's just getting through the daily steps. Sometimes just through the day, right, that gets you to the next level. And, you know, there's a lot of hope in that.
There is.
So I ended up, this guy, so this pastor, ended up taking me to Bible. He had a conversation with my father, and my father said, "You don't know this guy, like me. Like, you don't know him. You sure?" And I said the same thing. I was like, "You know what? He's right. You need to really be sure because you don't know me. Mm-hmm. I haven't finished school since the eighth grade." So he says, "Don't worry about that. God will take care of that." So he took me to colleges that he knew, and one of them was at Philadelphia College of Bible. Mm-hmm. And I guess he had friends at the school, and they just said, "Apply." I think I wrote the application in pencil. I was so delayed. I was boy interrupted. Mm-hmm. You think you have a hard time with math. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like the last thing I remember learning was multiplication, division, subtraction, and a little bit of geometry, a little bit of algebra. That was mm-hmm. it. Everything else, the reading, you know, I learned to read again by starting to read the Bible and the newspapers. And I, because my brain had, I was brain damaged at the moment, at that time, you know, mm-hmm. so that the activities I was involved in damaged my, and the trauma, I think, damaged my ability to think. All that had to recover. Mm-hmm. And Philadelphia College of Bible was the next recovery program. It was a recovery program. I am so grateful to them. As limited as things were, right? Small college, you know, very, very definitive way of thinking. But it gave me like two railroad tracks that I can get on and then get to the next step.
Mm.
And that's what it provided. And I became civilized. At college, I learned how to be a civilized person. I got manners. I learned what manners were. I learned what appropriate language was. I learned about study, and I learned about fairness and service.
Mm.
And I learned a different culture. I mean, this was a, for the most part, this was a white college, and the Jamaica Community Adolescent Program, that was all African American. And mm. where I came from was pretty much Latino, except for the Italians and the Greeks. And, you know, so it gave me like this whole new experience with the world. It was a whole new world experience for me.
Wow.
I can't tell you. I brought medicine with me because I didn't think there was going to be medicine here.
Really?
Yeah. I thought I was going to the woods. I didn't know where I was going.
Did you bring toilet paper?
The whole thing.
I brought, really?
And they laughed at me because I brought sugar cane. I also brought sugar cane and fruit, you know. And they're like, "What's that?" Sugar cane. You people don't have sugar cane? Are you living under a rock? How do you not have sugar cane? Like things like that. It was just it was just a completely different experience. Then I got a chance to study in Israel.
Mm.
And that was another increment. That was another step. But I'll tell you, there's nothing that was a bigger step than getting married,
mm.
having children, and having a career. When I thought I had myself together finally, that's when I realized that I really didn't have myself together. Mm. And it's taken a very, very long time to process where some of my anger comes from, and my rage, and my self-doubt, and my my depression. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that those things were things.
Mm.
Right? That they were issues. I thought so many things were, didn't feel right, but were like, let's talk about confidence, just confidence itself. I don't mm-hmm. think I actually became an adult, like a real confident adult, till maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yes. and I'm 56. I'm talking about 50, 51.
Okay.
And when I finally, you know, I lost my parents to cancer, and we took care of them, and I had to be the adult for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot, and my friends, mm-hmm. and all through those years that I'm talking about, I've developed some incredible relationships, and I have a community of people. You're one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You're one of them. And I have a community of people that have continued to contribute to my life more than I could ever contribute to them.
Mm-hmm.
I keep learning and growing.
I don't know though, Franco. I think you minimize your impact on others too.
Maybe I might, but I don't. I guess the thing is, I'm not. I don't want to be arrogant in assuming that I can impact someone. Because the truth is, if someone's impacted, right, it's because they have decided to take something on, whether it's the help you're giving them or the encouragement you're giving them, and they're taking that and moving their lives forward, because the real work is up to them.
Yeah, right. Right.
The real work is up to them. My work is much easier when it comes to someone else's life. Now, but without trying to sound arrogant, I've done a lot of good.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I used to think it was to make up for the bad, but it's not. It's not, because the bad is gone. It's washed away. There's consequences. There's always consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And some consequences last a lifetime. And let me tell you something funny, because this is funny, right? The other day, I hope you think it's funny. I hope so. You might edit this out, but this is funny. So the other day, right, I get a letter from the doctor that did my colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know what a colonoscopy is, right?
Everybody, I do.
Right?
Okay. I do. Yeah.
So he did my colonoscopy and he retired. And this is funny. Dr. Moses, actually. And I took the letter and I looked at it and I was sad for a moment that he retired. And I'm thinking to myself, why am I so sad about why he retired? He did my colonoscopy. He was a nice doctor. We talked. And I'm thinking about it, and I said, you know what? It's because he's one of the men I know that was very kind to my backside. he's the kindest man that had ever touched my backside. And that's what I mean. Things, you know, things linger in your head, because when you've had a bad experience, right, the good experience just seems so much better, you know? Though I'll never trust the anesthesiologist ever. But Dr. Moses, him I'll trust. And I was sad. I was like, he was such a good man. And, you know, so like I said, some things linger that are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, but for the most part, you move on.
Mm.
You know, and if you believe in God. Now, here's the other thing. If you believe in God, there's a lot of friends I have that don't believe in God. There's friends that I have that believe in the ways of Buddha. They believe in Muslims, you know, believe in Allah. I'm not going to, just like I'm not going to compare my suffering to someone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to compare my faith to someone else.
Mm.
I'll tell them what my faith means for me,
mm-hmm.
and that the grace of God has been incredible in my life. And they tell me about the grace of God in their lives, or just the grace of the universe, or the fact that, you know, whatever it is that keeps them going, I'm not going to knock it. Mm-hmm. Because who mm-hmm. am I to knock their, you know, their experience? I don't want to do that. But I'll talk with anybody anytime. Mm. So COVID was the last trauma I just went through, right? Mm. I wouldn't say one of the worst. The worst was seeing my mother suffer. Mm. But going through COVID was difficult.
Mm, I can't imagine.
And I didn't have it. I wasn't on a ventilator. All I had was the pneumonia. And when I say all I had was pneumonia, it was terrible. It was like moving toward the ventilator. Like I was like, oh my God.
Wow.
We're going to end up on an elevator. But I couldn't speak.
You couldn't even speak?
I couldn't get my sentences out. I could hardly speak. But I got better.
Hmm.
So, you know, I'm happy to have gone through it. And being on this side of it, like I'm happy that it's over, is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Not happy that I got it. I'm happy that it's over.
Mm-hmm.
But they said a lot of people feel a lot of trauma during that experience, and I can understand why. But I got calluses. I got trauma calluses. That was a trauma, but I don't know. I've had, you know, maybe I wish the younger you are, the worse you experience trauma. But no, mm-hmm. I've developed some calluses. And that's the other thing. There's hope in getting through things, because over time, you can literally become stronger through suffering. I don't want to imply that means suffering's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that that's one of the results in my life. As much as the suffering is real, so is the strength.
Mm. I'm just, so as I was listening to you talk, you just have this way of sharing, of talking, of reflecting, that it can make you laugh and it can make you cry. And at various points when you were talking, I felt tears starting to drop down my face. And then I was also like laughing. And it also makes me think about like how many of us can relate to these ups and downs, to these traumas, to these victories, to falling down, to getting back up again, to having doubts, to having fears, to having confidence and strength. And I really want to thank you for your vulnerability and thank you for sharing all these things that you didn't have to share. This is your narrative. And if you wanted to keep your narrative to yourself, that would be perfectly fine. But I also just want to acknowledge how appreciative I am. And I know how appreciative others will be that you were able to just connect with us in this way, as we are also experiencing these ups and downs as well.
Well, I want to thank you for, you know how I feel. You're brilliant. And I feel that there is so much you contribute to expression and what you do to provide a platform, whether it's through art or therapy or, you know, just talking about the stories is just talking about. It's through being able to talk about and putting me at ease to talk about it.
Mm.
That's all wonderful work. And I thank you for just for being who you are.
Thank you, Franco. So one more question for you. What is your vision for yourself in the future? Where do you see yourself moving forward?
That's a good question, right? Because so am I at the end or the beginning?
Mm.
That's what I keep asking myself. Am I at the end? Am I planning to get, you know, a house in a elderly community so I can, you know, just bide my time until I have to get cared for? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, I don't think so. I know that some things are coming to a natural end. Physically, it's going to be time, you know, within the next few years to retire from the fire department. Mm. To completely retire. That's a whole process. And I'll be continuing working, doing social work. I have a silly dream. Like, I've always had a chance to do the things I want. By the way, I really wanted to be a firefighter. Yeah. So that's something I got a chance to do that I really wanted to do. And I wanted to be a social worker. And that's something I got a chance to do. I'm afraid to say the other thing that I want.
Why are you afraid?
Because I don't know if I'll be able to do it. I feel like it's funny because at this point in my life, I feel like a teenager again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the middle part is I'm almost done with the middle part. I'm at the other end. So I want to have fun with it. Mm. I mean, I've had the chance, right, to do all these other things and I feel great about it, but I want to have fun with the end part. And I would like to do comedy.
Yeah.
I would like to do comedy. It just to do it. And and I would like to continue to contribute. Maybe to study again. Mm. Start studying again and
maybe going for the doctorate.
Write a little bit. I've thought about that, but see, when you have four kids, so the my contribution to my family is not over, so I don't know if I can afford it.
Okay.
I don't know if I could afford to go back to school. Okay. Like that. That would be great. That would be great. But I have a 16-year-old that has to get through school. So I have to mind him first. And I'm thinking I want to do something fun, but I hear comedy's not so fun.
Huh.
But I won't.
Really?
Well, they struggle. You know, a comedian that has to earn a living struggles. Right. The thing is, I may not be so dependent on earning a living. Mm. So maybe I could have fun with it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So does that sound silly to you?
Not at all. You are one of the funniest people that I know. And you have stories for days. like you had, and then the way that you tell stories.
Thanks. I would love to.
I can't wait to sit at the show and just laugh. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Franco. We appreciate it. I appreciate you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Real Stories. The resources referenced by today's guest speaker will be included in the episode description. For more information about me, Dr. Megan Corrado, and my work with the Stories Trauma Narrative Intervention, please visit my website, www.storiesguide.com. Also, feel free to follow my Stories social media pages on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember that for every story of trauma and adversity, there is always a story of strength and resilience.